Washington and WBAI in New York. I'm Sue Goodwin.
Rana Show with your host Zain Al-Amin. This is a show that focuses on Arab culture and politics, and it airs every Wednesday for 1 hour at WPFWFM.org and WBAI-FM.
Oh, say, can you see by the blood in the streets that this place doesn't smile on you, colored child? Whose blood built this land with sweat and their hands? But you'll die in this place, and you're this is not the land of the free. But the
Thanks, Michael. Welcome to the Shai Nana Show. I've been traveling and I'm back here to DC. And I'm noticing how things have been turning. I should call it tacking, because it's slowly turning. Especially, I'm referring to the situation in Gaza and in the Middle East in general. First of all, people are acknowledging that this attack by the U.S. and Israel on Iran was a total failure, and that the damage done to Israel has been tremendous in terms of the Iranian missiles that hit Tel Aviv. And those reports have been leaking out slowly. But the most exciting news, of course, is that we do have a class war now in the United States. Not only are people like in LA and all over the United States and in places like Chicago and in Washington, DC, are confronting ICE and the police in terms of their attack on immigrants, but we're having an exodus of ICE members from the organization, especially that when they're sort of unmasked because they've been wearing masks, and where people are finding out where these people live and what communities they live in, and basically confronting them there. Another, of course, development that's been amazing is Zohran Mamdani's win in New York in the Democratic primary for the mayor of New York. And not only did he win, despite the fact that his own party, the Democratic Party, tried everything they can to put wrenches in his works, he won the most. Now we're finding out that he won the most total votes in a primary in New York City history. I repeat, that's the most total votes in a primary in New York City history, period. So obviously he has a good shot at winning, becoming a mayor, despite his own party right now doing everything it can to trip him up, because you know the Democratic Party is the party of corporate America, and Zohran's all his talking points, all his goals have to do with making the city more accessible for working class people, meaning more affordable for working class people through helping them with grocery stores, helping them through childcare, helping them through wages, etc. And of course, through making buses and public transportation more affordable in general. Very basic things that he's asking for, the Democrats are having a hard time figuring out how to basically trip him up without exposing themselves as agents of Israel, that they care more about a foreign country than the city of New York. And having said that, it's really an important thing, as our own mayor is resorting to the same old failed attempts at doing the same things that previous mayors, who I call the four horsemen of the apocalypse, have done. She's a nasty piece of work, our mayor. She's literally following the dictates of Trump without actually talking with Trump, meaning she's paralleling that program of attacking working class people and putting forward things like the stadium plan, which tonight there's going to be a meeting about that. Stadiums never, every economist will tell you that stadiums never benefited working class people. So instead of doing what Zohran's importance is, that he's putting forward these basic things that are exposing things like our DC mayor's failed policies, showing how these are 20th century policies that have never have destroyed cities en masse and caused gentrification and ethnic cleansing of people of color in every urban center. By the way, ethnic cleansing doesn't have to require violence, even though there is a factor of violence that the police is involved in gentrification. So he's exposing what mayors can do in every urban area, and it really leaving our own mayor basically naked, with in a sense of figuratively naked, with the attempts of diverting money from our pockets through ridiculous things like putting cameras on stop signs and charging people $100 if they don't come to a full stop at a stop sign. Who do you think that hurts? Working people. So please join any effort to fight our mayor, especially that we have now a model to put up like Zohran, and ask her why isn't she applying those things that have gained Zohran the most total votes in a primary in New York City history. Another amazing piece of news that's happening on the international level is that we have the largest union in the United States. The National Education Association had just cut ties with the Anti-Defamation League. For those of you who are familiar, the Anti-Defamation League have been poisoning every campus and every public school in DC and other schools in terms of weaponizing anti-Semitism in a very problematic way, of course, to basically shut down free speech. And the reason, of course, the National Education Association cut ties with the ADL is because it's been shown not to be a civil rights organization, but rather a lobbying group for Israel. And lastly, of course, many of you heard about the punk group Bob Villain, not Bob Dylan, but Bob Villain, how they've become stars after being kicked out of several festivals after their calls for to support Palestine and to condemn the IDF. And instead of Bob Villain basically falling in the charts and such, they're actually getting more views and listens on Spotify and so on. And also they are getting a lot of solidarity from other groups. Every single major summer music festival in the world has featured some aspect of Palestinian solidarity. It's become hip to do that, you know, and even for people who didn't care about Palestine before, they know that they can gain more popularity around the world because the world is turning for Palestine right now. Even the running of the bull in Spain has featured a huge, has started with calls for solidarity of Palestine, where people that are about to face the running bulls in the streets formed the map of Palestine with their own bodies in a cheering celebration of Palestinian solidarity. So that's the news for today. And I just wanted, in light of the 4th of July, I wanted to start the show by playing Jill Scott's version of the national anthem. And then we'll get to the other piece of news. Oh, sorry that I came in late. I didn't realize that it was already played. So we're going to dive in right now into an interview with Helen Cobain that the Electronic Intifada did, sort of an assessment, a recent assessment of what really happened. As you know, we're just finding more information now as it leaks out about what really happened in terms of this attack on Iran and its retaliation. So let's have a listen to that.
I'll just remind people that they're watching the Electronic Intifada live stream, and I'm Ali Abonehmeh here with my colleague, Nora Barros-Friedman. On June 13th, Israel launched a surprise attack on Iran under the pretext of targeting its nuclear research facilities and its ballistic missile program. Israel and its sponsors in Washington all but openly admitted that their real goal was regime change in Tehran. Weakening Iran is seen from Tel Aviv and Washington as key to defeating the resistance to U.S. hegemony in the region and ending specifically the resistance in Palestine. But Israel achieved none of its goals during the 12-day war, or did it? We'll talk about that. But despite early tactical successes, such as murdering Iranian commanders, scientists, and their families, Tel Aviv had to seek a cessation of hostilities as Iran's powerful response exhausted Israel's air defenses, shut down its ports and airport, paralyzed its economy, and devastated strategic sites. Far from weakening Iran's government, the Israeli attack rallied and united the Iranian population and strengthened its international standing. But few can be in doubt that even if Iran prevailed in this round, Israel and the U.S. will not let the country live in peace. To discuss these developments and what might come next, we're joined now by Helena Cobain, a writer with decades of experience and knowledge about the region. And Helena directs Just World Educational. Welcome back to the Electronic Intifada live stream, Helena.
Oh, it's great to be with you. It's great that you're back on the air. I missed you guys for the last 3 weeks. Just before we get into the discussion that we're going to have, I want to say I really appreciated what you said about how we keep going amidst all this like unfathomable, horrendous news. You know, some of us who are here in the United States as Palestine rights activists, spokespeople, advocates, I mean, it's particularly hard for us, I think, because it's our government that is directing and funding a lot of this. But there is good news. And I want to tell you that my two New York City-based grandkids don't even have the right to vote yet, but they were out there campaigning for Zahran Mamdani. And so, you know, there is good news. We do make a difference, but it takes a long time. So just wanted to say that. Anyway.
It's good to see you, Helena.
West Asia, whatever.
Yeah. Well, thank you so much for that, Helena. And yes, it's important to see the signs of rejection of the status quo, that people are taking every opportunity they can. And so that's another positive reinforcement. Well, let's look at let's start with what happened with the U.S.-backed Israeli attack on Iran. We'll get into some of the detail, but just give us your sort of headline, big picture view. Do you think I gave a fair summary of Israel's goals and U.S. goals? And what do you think the outcome was? Give us sort of your high-level overview.
Okay, just a snapshot. First of all, I think we need to describe this thing as a U.S.-Israeli attack from the get-go. It was a joint effort. It was not U.S.-backed Israeli attack. It was a U.S.-Israeli attack that was coordinated from long ago, actually. The timing was not at all coincidental. They had been planning this for a very long time. Actually, before October 7th of 2023, they were already doing some of the planning for this. And if you recall back then, the Israeli military was like, damn, we have to do something about Gaza, whereas we had all been focused on, first of all, knocking out Hezbollah and then the rest of the region-wide axis of resistance. And now we have to like get our hands dirty in Gaza. So we know that they have been planning this a long time, along with the head of the U.S. CENTCOM. For some reason, the U.S. military has a military command called CENTCOM that is located on a completely different continent than ours. But, you know, that's become kind of normalized, but it does. And their director, Air Force General Michael Kurila, has been working hand in glove with the Israelis for a long time planning this. So I think that's very important to understand. I would look at this as having a number of different levels of what they were aiming to do. I think they wanted to dismantle Iran's command system. Now, you can call that regime change, but, you know, regime change actually also involves having a lot of local allies who raise, you know, color revolution type slogans. And they never really had that, honestly. You know, there are some ethnic minorities. There are some people like the MEK, which was until recently described as a terrorist group by our government. There's, you know, the son of the ancient Shah. There are little tiny people who want to, you know, portray themselves as potential successors in Tehran. But they just, I think what Kurila and the Israelis wanted to do was dismantle the Iranian regime. And if that meant complete regime like collapse, complete social chaos, as we've seen in Libya, then so be it. I mean, I think that's a way of looking at the regime change. I think there was an opportunistic aspect to this. Obviously, Trump coming in gave the Israelis and Kurila and his people a lot of hope that they would get more support for this than they did from the Biden people. And it's also, you know, what happened on October 7th of 2023 completely vaporized the Israelis' kind of aura of invincibility on which they base their so-called deterrence. It disappeared, you know? So they have to be able to reestablish the credibility of Israel's deterrent force, military force. How do they do that? You know, they thought that, you know, dismantling the government in, well, in Lebanon, you know, honestly, it was horrible for the Lebanese people, but that wasn't serious enough for the Israelis to be able to reestablish their deterrence. So it had to be Iran, and they had to do it when they could. So they had been planning this whole campaign through the IAEA, okay, the International Atomic Energy Agency, going back to like the early years of this century. They have had some niggly little doubts, or they create evidence, like the kind of evidence that was created around chemical weapons during the civil war in Syria. And then they, you know, demand that the IAEA take, you know, forceful action. And meantime, they have actually infiltrated the IAEA in very important ways. We are now seeing the gray zone has of the cradle has a really important new report on the degree to which Palantir and its tool called Mosaic have actually been used by the IAEA in order to feed, like, two ways, information from the Israelis to the IAEA, and then information from the IAEA inspections to the Israelis. So, you know, the IAEA sends somebody to inspect a nuclear facility. And remember, Iran is allowed to have nuclear technology, nuclear production, nuclear enrichment up to a certain level. What it's prevented from doing under the NPT is weaponization. Mm. We can come to that later.
Yeah. So we'll talk more about the International Electronic Energy Agency. But that you kind of laid out the broad goals there. We know that towards the end of this 12-day war, President Trump ordered the U.S. military to bomb these three Iranian nuclear sites, and then he swiftly declared victory. And there's been sort of this back and forth in the U.S. media about was the strike successful, was it not successful, how do you define that? Talk about how you see the political and military impact of that U.S. strike. And let's get this question out of the way. How much is Iran's nuclear program just a distraction from real U.S. and Israeli objectives? I mean, with Iraq, when we talk about, and this is true with Syria as well, but with Iraq, you know, the whole pretext for the war was weapons of mass destruction, that Iraq supposedly had hidden stocks of chemical and biological weapons, and even they suggested nuclear weapons, which all of this was a lie. And we know that this was all besides the point. The real point was to topple the government in Iraq. Is that this? I mean, put that with that context, what are your thoughts about how much this is actually a concern with Iran, or is it just a pretext?
Good question. I think it is largely a pretext. And I also think that the corporate media here in the West has been majorly distracted by this whole question of, you know, was Trump speaking the truth when he said that they've the reports from the Defense Intelligence Agency. And that's all that they're like talking about in the corporate media. Meantime, the basic fact that Israel suffered very bad damage during the war, damage it has never suffered before. I mean, we can see some of the reports of that coming out in Haaretz and other places now very belatedly. But the U.S. corporate media has said nothing about this for a couple of reasons. One, you know, the editors don't want to get into, oh, gee, you know, Israel is actually very fragile and very ill protected and very vulnerable. And number two, all the reporters working in Israel are subject to military censorship. So, you know, even there have been a couple of cases where a Fox News reporter, for example, was standing not far from the Israeli Defense Ministry when it got bombed by one of the Iranian missiles. And, you know, he started to say, started to do the reporting on that, you know, that this is the Israeli Defense Ministry. And you know, security people immediately came and swept him off. I know I've worked as a reporter in Israel, and, you know, especially in times of war, you are subject to very tight military censorship. They never tell us this, you know, on the Western corporate media. They always say, oh, you know, we're prevented from going into Gaza because, you know, so we can't actually, you know, verify what all these Gaza health ministry people are telling us, you know, so it's like it's terrible. We're not allowed to go into Gaza, but they never tell you we are also subject to censorship from Israel. Really important for people to understand that. But the bottom line of what happened during the U.S.-Israeli attack on Iran, which lasted for 12 days, you ended up with a mutually hurting stalemate. Both sides agreed to move back. The Iranians obviously had suffered quite a lot, including, you know, many hospitals and research centers and completely non-military targets having been hit. And as Ali mentioned, obviously some of the key military commanders and nuclear scientists who were directly targeted at the beginning, and we can talk more about that later. But the Israelis also had suffered, as you said, huge economic and social losses that they had never experienced before. So there, I have to say that they have not succeeded either in toppling the Iranian regime, Iranian government, and they have not succeeded in reestablishing the credibility of Israel's military deterrence. So from that point of view, it has actually been a loss for the Israelis.
Helena, you had mentioned coverage in Haaretz, and I wanted to show this article, maybe the one that you're referring to. And the headline is, and Tamara, I dropped that in the chat. The headline is, chilling maps show Iran's missiles obliterated Israeli neighborhoods. And this article describes massive, massive damage, thousands of buildings, hundreds of buildings, thousands of individual units damaged, many buildings completely destroyed. But there's a couple of telltale things about this article. If you look at that subhead, it says, from Tamra to Tel Aviv and further south, Israeli engineers' maps show how a shockwave from Iran's ballistic missiles can be as ruinous as a direct hit. So they're largely talking about secondary blast damage and shockwaves. But what's strangely missing from the article is any discussion at all of what the targeted sites were, what was actually directly hit or directly aimed at. There's no mention in this article of Israeli military or strategic sites that were hit, albeit that it describes unprecedented, as you put it, damage in many parts of Israel. What do you know about what the Iranians targeted?
I don't know a lot beyond that. That piece in Haaretz was like yesterday or maybe the day before, but very much later than, I mean, you know, they held to the story a long time before they released it. That's worth noting. It wasn't like reported in real time. I've seen other reports that the Israeli Defense Ministry at the Kiryat was targeted. The Weizmann Institute of Science, which was a, you know, major military science center, and several of the other university departments that do military science have been targeted, which would be kind of analogous, you can say, to what the Israelis were targeting in Tehran when they killed, you know, they did targeted killings of Iranian nuclear scientists and other scientists, as well as off-duty leading officers. Remember, on June 13th, the Iranians were still preparing for the June 15th session of the nuclear talks with Trump. So presumably many high military people were just sleeping at home. You know, when somebody is not in active combat, you're not allowed to target them. We need to remember that. You know, that's why they use the term non-combatant as opposed to civilians or military. The distinction in humanitarian law is between combatants, people who are in active combat, and non-combatants, which includes active military people who are on vacation or sleeping at home with their families. And we need to remember how they had targeted Ismail Haniyeh in Tehran earlier, and then how they have targeted so many individual scientists, leaders, writers, and of course, our dear friend Rifat al-Arir in Gaza and many individuals in Lebanon and the West Bank using electronic signals. You know, Rifat was targeted through his cell phone. And I don't know exactly how they had targeted these Iranian scientists and military people. I do note, however, that Iran has just said they're not going to be using GPS anymore because that's a potential vulnerability. They're going to be using a Chinese navigational system called Beidou, which actually is called Beidou Systems and is sometimes referred to as BDS. So there you go.
Helena, let's talk about the ceasefire that, you know, was declared after the 12 days. What prompted the U.S. to seek that ceasefire? And do you think it'll hold? And in the meantime, what did we learn about both Israel's and Iran's military capabilities in this, you know, in that 12-day war? And I think, of course, also, what did we learn about the U.S.'s willingness to expand a regional war? Or, you know, basically, what are your thoughts on the ceasefire and do you think it'll hold?
I think it might hold for longer than people think. I'm not going to make any direct predictions, but it was a ceasefire that was kind of by mutual agreement. It wasn't, you know, painstakingly negotiated like the ceasefire that Trump claims he's negotiating, you know, on Ukraine or claims he's negotiating on Gaza. This was like both sides, all three sides, well, on the one side, the US and Israel, and on the other side, Iran, said, whew, let's just like take a step back or three steps back or whatever. On the US-Israeli side, specifically the Israeli side, Israel has this multi-layered missile defense system, and only the lowest level of it is called the Iron Dome, and that the Iron Dome defends against, you know, small rockets. I call them bottle rockets, but they're not, you know, small rockets of the kind that the resistance in Gaza, by the way, continues to send against Israel, and that Hezbollah used to have a lot of. Then they have the Arrow 2 and Arrow 3 up higher and higher. And those are very expensive interceptor missiles that that the Israelis use. And that's kind of locked in with this U.S. high altitude system called the THAAD, Terminal High Altitude Air Defense. The THAAD is a completely 100% U.S. system, and they deployed it to Israel. I can't remember exactly when, but it was definitely used in absolute, you know, lockstep integration with the Arrow systems during the 12-day war. That's why I call it the U.S.-Israeli war on Iran, because it was a joint operation. So they were running out of interceptor missiles. I mean,
I can speak to this from firsthand experience. I just came back from Jordan and I watched the entire 12-day war. I live tweeted a lot of the missile attacks because we could literally see everything in the sky above us in Jordan. And it was notable at the beginning of the war, the first couple of days, that you know, the air raid sirens would go off in Jordan. And so I'd go up to the roof and you would see interceptors going up from the west, in other words, from the direction of Israel, before you would see Iranian missiles arriving. And towards the end of the war, there were very few interceptors going up. Now, that might be a combination of the fact that the Iranians were clearly using different kinds of missiles towards the end, which were coming in much faster and at a much steeper angle. But even when I saw the ballistic missiles that sort of came on a more kind of, let's say, relaxed pace, there were not as many interceptors going up. That was just very clear.
Yeah, I thank you for the tweeting, Ali. I mean, you and a few other people from Jordan were giving us this like kind of front row view of what was happening. Must have been weird for you to be looking at that and to know that essentially the Jordanian government was 100% supporting the American-Israeli attack war there. I think. The Iranians have been planning for this kind of a war for a long time. I just read a really interesting article in The Cradle, and I wish I could send you the link, but I'm not supposed to do anything on my computer while I'm talking. A great article in The Cradle, which is a kind of a review of Iran's ballistic missile programs, going back to the original U.S.-backed Iraqi attack against the Iranian revolutionary regime that I covered as a journalist in September of 1980, when Saddam Hussein invaded Iraq with the help of Iran, with the help of some Iranian dissidents and a lot of help from Donald Rumsfeld and others. So, yeah, they have been developing their ballistic missile and drone and coordination capabilities ever since then. I mean, the amount of losses that they took in that war in the 1980s was stupendous. You know, whole generations of young Iranians went to the battlefield and were killed. So now they have like a very complicated set of different attack and defense capabilities at various different altitudes. Oh, thank you, Ali. Ali just put it in the, So they held back some of the more advanced ones at the beginning, as Ali mentioned, and these are the hypersonic missiles that go really high. And then they also have the drones that kind of creep along, not exactly hugging the ground, but also, you know, fairly low. So what you had was a situation where the U.S.-Israeli war campaign was capable of maintaining a kind of an air bridge right across Jordan for those waves of Israeli bomber planes that would traverse the, 1,800 kilometers from Israel to Iran and then drop their bombs. One of the early missions, of course, had been to wipe out Iran's air defense capabilities. So they were capable of coming in at that level and bombing additional Iranian sites. But what they were not capable of doing was detecting and intercepting all the low-level ground huggers or the very high, very fast ballistic missiles. So that's why Iran suffered really badly, obviously, including, you know, many military sites in addition to these non-military sites and the hospitals and so on. But Israel also suffered. That's why I call it a mutually hurting stalemate. Have we learned about the capabilities? I think we've learned that Iran has a much more capable military and military command system than what the Israelis had been planning on. You know, they had thought that by assassinating in those early hours of June 13th, that they could completely cripple Iran's entire command and control system. But the Iranians have been used to this in the past, like many of the other parts of the axis of resistance in West Asia. They have built in redundancy and redundancy and redundancy and resilience so that even if the Israelis were able to wipe out the head and many other other leaders of the IRGC, the Iranian Revolutionary Guard Corps, still there were backup systems that were capable of organizing what turned out to be a very sophisticated response.
Thanks for that. Remembering back to the days of the 2003 U.S. invasion of Iraq. And, as Ali mentioned before, all of these, these propaganda campaigns very similarly popping up again, Iran has weapons of mass destruction and they have a rogue nuclear weapons program. Yes, exactly. And, it was interesting, I think, to many people to see that the U.S., was employing the same rhetoric and the same propaganda, but 12 days is a very short amount of time, in comparison to the years-long invasion and occupation and destruction of Iraq. What can you say about talk a little more about the U.S.'s kind of stance here and why, a 2003 invasion of Iraq style war against Iran was impossible for the U.S. to pull off.
So when George W. Bush invaded Iraq in 2003, as you've both noted, obviously they used much of the same sort of weapons of mass destruction, manufacturing consent through fear in that way. But they had also systematically strangled Iraq at that point through 13 years of very, very tight sanctions. So, there have been sanctions on Iran for just as long, maybe even longer. But we are now, so the invasion of Iraq happened in 2003. What on earth?
it's AI from your camera. Yeah. No, it's
okay. Oh, God. I'm sorry. I don't know if people saw that. That was horrible. But, okay. Now I'm very spooked. Very spooked. So, okay. This time, the Iranians have learned to deal with the sanctions much more effectively than Saddam was ever able to do. Iran is a much bigger country than Iraq. It has a big hinterland, like it has relations with Russia, obviously, on its northern border and with many other countries around its borders, including Pakistan. And Afghanistan is a little iffy, but long story short, the what I call team sanctioned, which is the kind of the unofficial team of all the countries against whom the United States has wielded sanctions, most of those sanctions being completely outside of the UN system. You know, unilateral coercive measures is what they are called in international parlance. So, you know, they sanction this country and that country, and then they sanction Russia. When they added Russia to team sanctioned, they strengthened team sanctioned considerably.
And the irony is, when they sanction you like that, they force you to become self-sufficient or to develop those other relations. So, you know, an Iran, a country that would, say, be dependent on U.S. military technology and on contracts to service its warplanes, you know, by Grumman or Boeing or whoever, is a country that can never go to war against the United States or never defend itself against the United States. Whereas a country that has been sanctioned and has to develop its own indigenous technology or get them from other countries that are sanctioned isn't, I mean, is the US inadvertently helping these countries?
Yes, I think that's been the effect of this like rush to sanctions that we've seen for the last, well, since Clinton, honestly. Another little point about the relationship with other countries. In that article that we had up a little while ago about Iran's development of its ballistic missile programs, they did note that they got a lot of technology from North Korea back in the day. And another important piece of this story, of the June 13th attack story, is that just at the end of May of this year, the first train arrived in Tehran, having traversed the brand new and very highly invested China-Iran railroad system. I mean, you know, I don't know how many trains have come and gone along this. It takes, I think, about 12 days for a train to go up through a lot of the stands and you know, across the whole of China and to end up, you know, from Beijing or from Xi'an, which is a wonderful city in eastern China, all the way across to Tehran. This is new. You know, I've actually just been reading a little bit about the British Empire in Africa and how in the 19th century, the British were desperate to, you know, connect Cairo to Cape Town. So they wanted a railroad, you know, and the French, a north-south railroad. And the French were meantime trying to build an east-west railroad. And that was the big, you know, like how you undergird your empire. So the Iranians now have a direct rail link to China. And I think that's also maybe part of the timing for the US-Israeli whole relationship with China becomes a really big thing. And of course, it has completely backfired, like all those sanctions that you mentioned. Because
let's talk about that, Helena. We're going to talk about how this impacts Gaza. But since you started to talk about China, let's keep that train of thought going. You'd mentioned earlier Iran's strategic location. Of course, it's central to this China's Belt and Road Initiative, and the railroad is part of that. But also, Iran is a very close neighbor to Russia. They both share the Caspian Sea, and Iran and Russia have strategic relationships where Iran can provide Russia with access to warm water ports for trading and other purposes, potentially. So talk about how, in a recent blog post, you wrote about the very significant contribution that China has made behind the scenes to strengthening Iran's resilience, as well as its defensive and offensive military capabilities. Those are your words. How do you think this conflict has been viewed, is being viewed by China? And let's also talk about Russia. How have they reacted? How do you think they will be adjusting their policies in the wake of this US-Israeli joint attack on Iran?
So if we go back to that session of the IAEA Board of Governors that was held on June 12th, I can't remember if I've mentioned this yet, but this was a crucial part of the preparation for the attack that we know was launched overnight between the June 12th and June 13th. In other words, while the Board of Governors of the IAEA was voting on this very dodgy resolution, they're not in compliance with their obligations. So that was passed on June 12th, even while the Board of Governors of the IAEA was deliberating on that resolution. The Israelis and Americans were already starting to take place overnight. We know that. I mean, obviously, they were doing that. So in that deliberation at the Board of Governors of the IAEA, direct participation in the bombing, U.S. bombing and of the Israeli, completely unprovoked attack. I mean, this, we need to underscore again and again, like, how unprovoked all these are. June 22nd was the representative of Kuwait who was speaking as a representative of all the GCC countries, which you know are the six Arabian Peninsula countries. They don't include Yemen. So it's basically all those little emirates down the Arabian coast of the Gulf, Bahrain, and Kuwait up at the top of the Gulf, and Oman and Saudi Arabia. That's the Gulf Cooperation Council. They also expressed strong opposition to the U.S.-Israeli bombing of Iran. That is very significant. You know, in an earlier era, let's say if this had happened 5-10 years ago, Washington would have confidently expected that the GCC countries would line up behind any attempt the government.
That was the Electronic Intifada. That is
the death toll from the Texas floods now stands at least 119.
60 people who remain missing looks less and less likely as the rescue team enters its fifth day. Also notable are the extreme floods which occurred in New Mexico yesterday, killing three and sweeping away entire houses. Two of those killed by floodwater in New Mexico is that the region's thin soil combined with intense rainfall to create extreme and rapid flooding conditions. Artificially controlling the Guadalupe River may be the only way to guarantee this disaster never happens again. From WPFW News, I'm Noah Portner.
In other news, at least 40 Palestinians, including 10 members of a family sheltering in a tent, were killed in Israeli airstrikes in the Gaza Strip, hospital officials said today. The strikes came as President Trump pushes for a ceasefire that might end the war and free dozens of Israeli hostages. Trump met with Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu for the second time in 2 days at the White House last night, but there was no sign of a breakthrough. Hamas has insisted that any deal must pave a path to a complete and lasting cessation of hostilities. Netanyahu has insisted that Israel will agree to that only if Hamas's military wing and government are dismantled. Meanwhile, the United Nations is warning that the fuel crisis in Gaza due to the Israeli blockade has reached a critical point and will cause further deaths and suffering in the besieged Palestinian territory. In more news, Russia launched a record 728 drones at Ukraine overnight in what the Ukrainian Air Force called the largest more than 3 years ago. Ukraine claimed most of the drone attacks were intercepted by its air defense units. The attack comes after the Pentagon said on Monday that it will send additional defensive weapons. President Trump, reversing a Pentagon decision a week ago to pause air defense shipments already on the air. The bombardment also comes after Trump, during a cabinet meeting yesterday, joined the conflict on his first day in office. And the Supreme Court yesterday lifted a lower court order that blocked sweeping layoffs of federal workers at nearly 24 agencies while a legal battle over President Trump's plans to drastically cut the size of the government